Oh, my kidney. They aimed for the ass and they got my kidney.
Oh, all of a sudden, yeah.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, jeez.
Welcome to the Xanadu Cinema Pleasure Dome with Melissa Kircher and Wendy Bowlesby.
Welcome, dear listeners. Melissa here. This week we have for you part two of our discussion with author, screenwriter, and movie critic C. Robert Cargill. In case you missed last week's episode, here's what's going on. The audio from part one was recorded live at Convergence 2014. We only had an hour to discuss a pretty big subject, so we decided a couple days later to continue our discussion at a friend's house. Once again, the audio quality is not ideal. The recording happened on the same night as our episode with Megan Murphy, which means we were still recording with a Rock Band microphone. Rock Band meaning the video game. As I said, not ideal. So I had to do some heavy noise removal and leveling to make our discussion easier to hear, which means you will sometimes hear some artifacts from these digital manipulations. But enough of that. Please enjoy our continuing discussion about writing female characters for film.
Probably a good place to start if we left off with naming feminist characters in movies, so maybe we could do a couple more, use them as launching off point.
Yeah.
That will kind of be a nice little segue from the first recording to the second recording.
Yeah. You know who one of my favorite feminist characters right now is actually from a TV show?
Okay.
I love May from Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah,
the cavalry, and she's such a cool character, and she's, you know, she's really awesome. But what's most awesome is how they built up her legend, and how she hates her legend.
Yeah,
and she's that kind of classic hero who doesn't like it, and is always like, you know, they're like, oh, you're the coward, don't call me that, and then everybody kind of telling the story mutating from person to person. And then the first time she shows up, she really is the cavalry. Like, she kicks everyone's ass. and she's my favorite character on that show. She's just such a cool, interesting,
badass. A woman.
But and still very what, much a woman.
And that's what I appreciate, is that so often when a character becomes strong, a character becomes less female. Right.
Yeah.
That's how we make a character, a woman strong, is you make her, you turn her into a man.
Well, we were discussing this earlier
at dinner.
At dinner, we were talking about Vasquez and the Vasquez problem.
Yes.
Which is, you know, because you were talking about you couldn't figure out when it was that it switched, that in order for a strong woman in a Hollywood movie to exist, she pretty much had to be butch.
Well, yeah. I mean, you look at film noir, you'd find all of these strong women who were also these bombshells. So,
and blatantly using their sexuality as a power tool.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And yeah.
And then Vasquez shows up in Aliens.
Which is fascinating because she's in the film with Ripley, who is a great female character in that she is emotional. She has a definite female vantage point that she's approaching the world from, especially with Newt being introduced in that film. So she's in the film with Ripley, and it's fascinating.
Well, yeah, but I mean, Vasquez is also a great character, even though she has very few lines in the movie compared to everybody else. You know, she's definitely a minor character. You get the sense that she's a very fleshed out character.
Oh yeah, she's even got relationships with all of her cohorts.
But what happened was she became the model for what came after.
Yeah,
and right.
So from that point on, a strong badass woman means she had to be butch as shit, and that's where we end up with essentially the Michelle Rodriguez role.
Yeah,
where Michelle Rodriguez keeps getting hired to play that same kind of role where you weren't allowed to, you know, imagine what like Fast and the Furious would be like if you flipped the actresses in that movie. If all of a sudden Jordana Brewster was Vin Diesel's girl, who was kind of the criminal, and it was, you know, the soft, tender, but still kind of awesome little sister to Vin Diesel was Michelle Rodriguez. And think of what an interesting turn that might be in terms of character archetypes. Huh. And seeing Jordana Brewster, who is fucking gorgeous, and, you know, who looks every bit as gorgeous in person, and is small and lithe and frail, being that tough girl that doesn't take shit from anybody and feels that she has to prove herself next to her brother because her brother's a legend. And then looking at the more butch-looking girl actually being tender and soft and falling in love with the undercover cop and having that whole I just actually screwed up the characters there a little bit, but
that's okay. I wouldn't know. I've never seen Fast and the Furious, any of their
it's
iterations.
Fun actually.
I had no judgment, just there's a lot of media I can't consume it all.
Yeah.
Anyhow, but point is that but if you flip those roles, it would make those characters even more interesting. And but no, you have the Michelle Rodriguez role, and then Michelle Rodriguez was hired by Cameron to come in and play the Vasquez role in Avatar.
Yes.
And they actually, the interesting thing there is that if you watch the extra hour of deleted stuff, her character is much more interesting. And when they trim that stuff out, she was turned into Vasquez.
Yeah.
And that in his version of Avatar, she actually falls in love with the nerd.
Oh yeah, I can see that. In even without having seen the extras, that would have played out.
And when she dies, it's such a big thing for him, and her death means a whole lot more in the film.
We were talking Game of Thrones earlier, or at least I was starting. Me and Megan were talking Game of Thrones earlier. Hello, we are recording this second half to the podcast. You know, part two. Wendy is coherent.
Days later.
Days after the first part
I've
of the
already
recording.
Apologized for that. I don't know how many. I'll apologize again. That was way too much whiskey, way too fast. Sorry about that, y'all. What?
Nothing. I'm listening to you and making eye contact like a good listener.
You do that in a judgy way sometimes. Did you know that? You have a judgy core.
I'm thankful that you're judging me for my judgmentalism.
I know, right? Okay, yeah,
dear listeners, there are four other people in this room with us, and they're all giggling madly into their hands.
So I was going to bring up another feminist character because we were talking about Game of Thrones. So it's obvious, but Ygritte, right? Am I saying that right?
Oh, Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know nothing, Jon Snow.
You know nothing, Jon Snow. Because she's got her own motivations. She's got her own loyalties. And yeah, she's there to be a foil for Jon Snow and to be his love interest. So maybe she's not the best choice, but oh well, that's the shit. Because she is, I like her because she's still female. And Jon Snow is an incidental to her overall goal, right? And her overall goal is, my people cannot live up here. And you people built a fucking wall to make sure we couldn't come live there. So screw you anyway. And that's her goal. And she is very locked into that. So I think that she becomes a very interesting and powerful character for those reasons. But even though, yeah, there's the romance part, but I am also one of those feminists who's like, why do we want a feminist character to not have any romance or any love? It's like, it's the problem of, why is emotion inherently bad? And you know what? People fall in love, and that's part, and feminists fall in love. And so we could also show feminist characters falling in love, and that would be okay.
So who did you want to mention?
I wanted to bring up, is her name Martha from Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? The Elizabeth Taylor character?
Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to bring her up because I think it kind of illustrates the difference between a good female character, like a fully fleshed out, really interesting, deep female character versus quote unquote strong female character, kind of the stereotypical character that is, you know, a woman who kicks ass but doesn't do much else.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, Martha, I think I have her name right. She's smart. She stands up to her husband. But she's also a tremendously broken person in a lot of ways. Yeah, but this is an interesting character, and one that you really want to watch throughout the piece, and somebody who feels like a real person with flaws. So I thought that might be an interesting point where we could talk about the quote unquote Trinity problem.
I do want to talk about that. Yeah. We have a lot to say, but there's a character I really like that's a lot like that. I was just trying to look up her name, but the character from the Devil Wears Prada.
Which one? There's many a fascinating character. Are you talking about the Meryl Streep character?
Yeah, Meryl Streep.
Yeah. That is a fascinating character.
She's great. And she has that great scene where she like lets down all the walls and you see, you know, the deep damage inside of her, and you see how everything's armor. And then at the end, you know, you have her like putting all those walls up again and doing, you know, everything the way she does. And she's just fascinating. And she's so powerful, and everyone's afraid of her. And then at the same time, they're not afraid to show how broken and damaged she is.
Uh-huh.
I really like that movie. And ultimately I have issues with that movie at the same time on a more philosophical level, because it's a really entertaining movie. It's a really great story. And there's a lot of great, interesting, characters in there. And especially when you're talking about feminism, there's great feminist characters in there. And then there's a terrible one called the protagonist, who just is this great, you know, kind of underdog that you really want to root for, who really kind of buys into everything and falls into it, and then decides, I'm going to throw it away, but keep the clothes. And it's very populist. It's very kind of giving into what the mainstream wanted. But really, that film is about Meryl Streep.
Yes.
And it's so, all of her scenes are just so good. And she's such a great, strong, powerful presence. And she's one of my absolute favorites when you want to talk about great, damaged female characters that have both strength and weakness.
Yes.
And I think that's, and that's the key. That's the key of any great character. And that's one of the things that what you get into when you're trying to write a great character is the best characters are characters that have some fatal weakness, some fatal flaw, and have strength.
Yeah.
And that's the thing where people, you know, talk about Mary Sue's, and the problem with Mary Sue's is they're just people who don't have that fatal flaw. They don't have that weakness.
Yeah.
And what you end up with is you end up with male writers in Hollywood afraid to write strong women with a weakness.
Well, if I'm weakening them, then aren't I doing bad things to them? And then I'm going to be criticized.
Yes. Yeah. That's very much what it is. And it's how can I create a flawed woman, because I'm going to be looked at and judged for that woman being flawed. I had that issue. I talked about that briefly, I think, in our last half of the podcast with Dreams and Shadows, which you read. And where I had two different critics call me out for, you know, writing these monstrous female characters where all the guys are awesome and all the women are evil. And it's like that, well, but see, you're giving me that look, because no, everyone in the book is a monster. And in fact, the only character who's strong enough to overcome their own nature is Molly.
Yeah.
And Molly's the one character who isn't trapped into their own nature. And that was something that was very specific that came from a long conversation I had with Jess, my wife, about how to go about writing this book that had male protagonists, that had, you know, all these monstrous females, and how to kind of do that. And what came out of it was, you know, this decision to make her the only character that could overcome it. Even the protagonist can't overcome his own nature. But that wasn't what any of the critics read into. What they saw.
Well, that's okay. You made up for it in Queen of the Dark Things. Queen of the Dark Things. I thought that was a problem in Dreams and Shadows at all. But Queen of the Dark Things, you definitely delivered some awesome female characters, which I really appreciated. Especially since, unfortunately, with Sinister, you're trapped by the nature of the beast. that there aren't very many female characters.
Here's the problem. I desperately wanted to write Sinister with a female protagonist. I wanted the Ellison character to be a woman.
Wow.
But I couldn't.
Huh.
And the reason is because of the audience. Because a father who forsakes his children for his career, well, that's a bad dad, but that's an understandable flaw in our society.
Yeah.
A mother who does it is an unrepentant bitch who we do not give any time to. And you will hate her for that.
It's true.
That scene where Claire Foley walks up to the door with a coffee that she's made for her dad, and he opens the door and goes, "Oh, thank you, honey." And his phone rings and he takes it and closes the door and she's just left standing there. If that had been a woman that had done that, the audience would have turned on us.
Oh, God, yeah.
They wouldn't have allowed it. I very much wanted that character to be a woman, but I wasn't allowed to write it. So I had to.
No, it's true.
Had to write it that way. And then you can't make Deputy So-and-so a woman, because as you see that relationship growing together, the audience is going to assume that maybe Ellison might have some feelings, or maybe the feelings that So-and-so has for Ellison are more of a romantic nature and less of just a fan nature. So we couldn't have that character be a woman. And then the only thing I could do was write the wife as strongly as I could.
Yeah. And you did. Yeah. You actually did a really good job with her, and
I love that she's actually right about everything.
Well, that yeah. there are two people. There are two people in the movie right about everything. Her and the sheriff at the beginning.
Yeah,
the sheriff at the beginning sets up the whole line of the movie. He's like, "This, you can't explain this, and even if you could, you wouldn't want to know the answer."
Yeah,
and then sure enough, by the end, you're like, "That's exactly what just happened."
I do not want to know the answer. I love that the wife is given in the ultimatum that, "Honey, we can't do this anymore."
Yeah, but I could not flip that dynamic. If I flipped that dynamic and it was the guy was right and the mother neglected her children, and everyone would hate that movie.
It's true. And I buy into it too, because I just re-saw at least the first half of Sinister before I fell asleep, because it was 3 a.m. in my defense. But when she takes that cup of coffee and he takes it and shuts the door, it's just sad.
Yeah.
You just feel sad for both the daughter and for the father that he's missing this moment that his daughter wants with him. But if it was a woman, yeah, that pissed me off.
Yeah.
It's like, wow, way to just not be paying attention, woman. And what the hell?
And so that leads into most of the problems that Hollywood has right now, is you have to write your characters to the expectations of the audience. That you can't just write what you want and put it out there, because there is a certain expectation. So what you're watching right now is Hollywood struggling against the expectations of the audience, and while trying desperately to they know women are out there, they know they've seen them.
Although apparently only how many percentage in crowd scenes?
I think it's 18%.
Only 18% of them have they seen. You know about that, right?
There's a study where they gauged audience reaction to crowd scenes based upon how many women versus men were in the crowd, mm-hmm. you know, percentage wise. And apparently, as the level of women increased to 50%, male members of the audience started getting uncomfortable at around 18%. Between 18% and 50%,
too many women.
Too many women. It feels weird.
It feels weird. There's something visually wrong.
Yeah.
Too many women. Yeah. I'm just like, that's really
horrifying.
Yeah.
And so now I've been paying attention to more crowd scenes, because Hollywood really only puts about 15% of a crowd as female in any crowd scene.
But the question of that is about what's the context of those crowd scenes? Mm-hmm. Because if you're talking about most Hollywood movies that use crowd scenes, use them for action scenes or use them for some kind of chase. And if you're putting, you're running through the crowd and it's random guys, you don't care if some random guy gets hit by a car and killed. If it's a woman, protective instincts kick in. It's like, why did they just kill a woman? Why are we putting women in danger? Now, if it's crowd scenes that are just general crowd scenes, like just walking through the street.
The mall. I don't know why, but I'm thinking specifically of Minority Report and like the mall, when they're in the mall with the balloons. That's the sort of crowd scene I picture.
Or what's his nose in midnight cowboy walking down the street in New York.
Yeah. But so where I was going with that was, since I so rudely interrupted you to go onto this tangent,
no.
I was bringing it back around and saying Hollywood's fighting against the expectations of, you know, the audience, and that leads to the Trinity effect, which is what you were just bringing up.
Yeah, where you have a quote-unquote strong female character, a woman who kicks ass and puts on the airs of being a quote strong woman, but it's really she really doesn't serve any other function in the story except to make the male protagonist look cooler by association.
Now, I disagree with that on Trinity in particular.
She's really only there for him to be in love with.
She does, like, essentially get rewarded to the male character at the end.
And her kiss magically brings him back to life.
Yeah.
So she's now the magically strong woman. Yeah. No, and I love Trinity. And I say that I love Trinity, but when you watch that movie with that lens, it's like, wow, she actually really does not do anything.
Does she have a personality outside being
cool?
And no, she really doesn't.
Yeah.
I mean, the she has that underlying story of she was told by the Oracle that she would fall in love with, you know, the one, and that essentially she is the divining rod that will ultimately discover the one and for certain show him the path.
Right.
But no, the thing is Trinity is essentially a sidekick.
Yeah.
And she kind of shares a dual mentor role with
Morpheus.
With Morpheus. Now what we were discussing earlier plays into what we were just talking about, which is it would be a much more interesting story if Morpheus were a woman.
Right.
But you can't do that because all of a sudden what you have is you have the woman brings in the one and the one is a man, and then the woman then gets captured and the man has to come and save her at the end.
Yeah.
And that creates a very serious problem with what is that message sending? So Trinity is the one that saves Neo. And that was very much how they do that. Neo does not save himself. Trinity saves him. And then he becomes the one that saves everyone. But he can't get through this without her saving his bacon several times.
Yeah,
and that's
that.
The role that she serves. Is she is essentially the protector. And they made the protector a woman and added in the love angle. That character, if that movie were made in the 80s, that character would have been a dude, and there wouldn't have been a love angle to it.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
So, but that becomes a problem because the thing is that the role that she's playing has nothing to do with her being a woman. And that was the one problem I had with that essay that coined the Trinity effect, because we just saw that same exact character in Role Reversal with Brosnan. Huh? And with, I believe his name is Sven. Is that the guy that
Kristoff.
The one she really falls
Sven
in love
is the,
with.
Sven is the reindeer.
Sven's the cannibalistic reindeer. No, that's a different panel I did.
Different panel. But yeah, so Kristoff. So he, if you watch that movie, he plays the exact same role as Trinity. Like, he does all of the same things. He's there to help her when she needs it.
Right.
But she is the protagonist. And then, you know, there's the hint of love, but he's the reward, but not really, because they were getting away from the whole we're not going to get married at the end thing, but they really kind of do, because, you know, that's what's supposed to happen. And he is the exact same character. It is a standard character trope of we need someone who does this and this, but we don't have the space to develop that any further.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the characters that get labeled with the Trinity effect of what that essay was about aren't actually there because of feminist problems. They're there because, well, we've got to have this character that does this. Why don't we make them a woman?
Well, here's a question going back to Trinity herself. Then why does she fall in love with Neo at the end? Does that serve a purpose rather than her just simply saving him one more time?
It's the purpose is one of pure populism in that,
okay.
Whenever you put the two most attractive people on the screen are going to be invariably drawn to one another, and the audience wants to see them together. And so they intrinsically added that into the plot so that it made sense and it didn't feel like a forced romance. But that is a standard problem that you have with mainstream storytelling. You've got to deliver on everything, because if they didn't hook up, mainstream audiences would have walked out going, I really want to see them get together. You know, Keanu really belonged with that Trinity girl. And I don't understand why they didn't end up just having, you know, end up together. Couldn't they kiss at least once? Couldn't we just at least get that? So they put that in there. So maybe,
you know, part of the problem just simply is nobody's fighting that particular
expectation.
Well,
or if they do, it's labeled as a different type of movie that's more arty and more thoughtful.
Right.
And so it doesn't actually change the cultural expectation.
Yeah, it's very hard. It's very weird when you have a movie with a male and a female, with male and female main characters that don't hook up at the end, and it really just messes with people, and so you absolutely have to.
Can you name a movie where that happened? Where there was a male and a female character who didn't hook up, and everybody was like, "What the hell? Why did they not hook up?"
Now that I'm on the spot, no. no, it's happened, and I'm trying to remember movies where that does happen, and I'm blanking at the moment.
Because I can only think of Casablanca.
Actually, Chasing Amy has that very odd, very weird
ending.
Yeah,
people don't like it. It's true.
Yeah, they hate that ending.
Actually, I love it, but
well, no, because it's brilliant because it's real.
Yeah.
And that movie starts off being goofy and then becomes very, very real at the end.
Yeah.
I feel that what's addressed in the Trinity Problem, for those of you that haven't read this, you're probably sitting there going, what's the Trinity Problem? Basic concept of the Trinity Problem is that Hollywood knows that women want strong female characters in the movie, so they put a female character in the movie and make her strong and awesome, but they don't know what else to do with her. It was tipped off by How to Train Your Dragon 2, mm-hmm. where apparently, I have not seen it yet, but apparently his mother shows up, and his mother's this really cool, interesting, you know, strong woman, and they have no other story element for her.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, she's a fascinating character. The things they show her doing, and the knowledge she clearly has, and the choices she's made in her life, that there's so much there to work with. And in essence, she shows up, becomes a magical mentor briefly, and then this woman who has been kicking ass for decades, the minute that somebody else is on the scene who's more of a protagonist, suddenly she has no capabilities whatsoever and has to be rescued.
Mm-hmm. But the, you know, you run into this problem. I think the thing that really kind of nailed this home recently was what happened with Brave.
Yeah.
So here we have, the movie's very flawed, but you have the great core story of this little girl who is supposed to grow up to be a princess, and she doesn't want to be a princess.
Nope.
She wants to be a badass. And that the whole movie's about her coming to that conclusion. And the movie self-contained in itself is a great little piece of kind of feminist cinema for little girls. And I think that's great. But if you go to Disneyland, you see her running around. You can see her running around in that dress that she hates. That mm-hmm. the one that in the movie she absolutely doesn't want to wear. And little girls can get pictures of their favorite little badass having given over to princess syndrome, because now she's one of the princesses. And they did not keep her as one of the princesses and keep her the way they should have kept her. Because the audience... there is an audience that wants them. And so you have to ask yourself, how do you do this? How do you, if you have a situation like I had in Sinister, where you can't make your protagonist a woman, where it doesn't work if it's a woman without the audience turning on you, and there isn't a great secondary role that also works, like, you know, with so-and-so, how do you put a strong woman into a film and find something for her to do when there's really nothing for her to do?
Because there's really only two roles in a film, like Sinister.
Yeah.
Well, maybe part of the answer is thinking outside the box a little bit, in that maybe a solution for Sinister would have been, maybe it's a lesbian couple who are married. you have two women in two very different roles with the children, and then you could have contrasting personalities. Now, I'm not saying that the American public at large is quite ready for that in a mainstream horror movie.
Oh no, that would have been a great movie that would have played on 10 screens.
Yeah.
And you could have watched it on VOD, and we would have been very popular in the gay community if it had turned out to work well. But it would have been seized on by the right as being a film that shows why gays shouldn't have children.
Oh yeah.
And then there would have been people in the gay community who would have taken that and said, is this movie entirely against gay couples?
Mm-hmm.
And because it's saying, look what happens when gays are given children. And you literally have to, these are the types of things you have to think about, the gender politics you have to think about in this day and age.
You're right.
But at the same time, it's important that we think about these things because we are at a weird pivotal point in history where we're actually able to start changing things.
Mm-hmm.
And we're actually able to reject what's come before us and say, this is how this was done wrong, and this is how we can do it right. But it's going to take a very long time to get it right. And the first thing we have to do is not change Hollywood. The first thing we have to do is change the perceptions of everyone else out there.
Yeah, because Hollywood is just a mirror.
Yeah. We will give you, the thing is, and I was talking about with this outside earlier with some friends, is Hollywood is not at a loss for original ideas. And everyone I have ever met in Hollywood they all want to make The Godfather.
Yeah.
They all want to make The Godfather. They all want to make the greatest movie ever made. They don't want to make crap. They want to make great films that people want to see. That's what they want to make. But they can only make what people want to buy, because they've only got a certain amount of money to make more money that they then use to make another movie. And so they have to sell us what we want. And if what you want is, white male protagonists and, subservient women, well, that's what you have to sell. You know, if you want strong female characters, we need more stories with strong female characters, and you need to go and see them, and you need to support them, and we need to start changing the perceptions of, you know, how we see certain things. I don't know that the motherhood perception will ever change. I don't know if we'll ever get away from that notion of a woman.
I actually do think that one could change. And here's why. Because the motherhood perception is tied into traditional parenting roles that have shifted radically in the last 10 years. And if that shift continues and parenting becomes much more equal, I do think that the reason that in particular the mother being cold is because the mother is supposed to be the main caregiver. The mother is still, there's this lag culturally with our cultural expectations. The mother is the main caregiver and the dad is the provider. And so when the mother is not emotionally connected to her children, she has failed to do her job, and therefore she's a bad person.
Except that the other element of that is we built up this myth of motherhood about we almost believe in, you know, supernatural biology and powers of mothers, mm-hmm. of their bond to their children, and
that's all bullshit.
And breaking that bond with the child is so much more profound than the guy who didn't carry that child around for 9 months. And it is, and in our society, we have a lot of problems with that. And this gets into one of the things I was kind of talking about, but cut off a couple of times by some crazed woman with whiskey. This element that we're talking about is the very core of the men's rights movement, you know, the MRA guys, the men's rights advocates.
Clarify.
That's what I'm getting to. When you get to the core of what the men's rights group, the core of them, where they started, you know, their warm, chewy center, the thing they run back to every time they pull out some crazy, you know, bugfuck idea that they're perpetuating. Their core is that the society that we built, men don't have any rights to parenthood in the eyes of the law the way that women do, and aren't treated in the same way with parenthood as women are. And the core of the men's rights movement was started by a bunch of guys who love their kids and weren't allowed to see them because the court awarded them the mother because the laws favored women. It's guys who have to pay 20% of each of their paychecks to children they never see and have never been allowed to know. And these guys were really bitter and wanted change, and they started banding together. And then the crazy started glomming on, and then misogyny started taking over. And normal guys were turned off by, you know, the Twitter, the Tumblr feminists, you know, the crazy far left feminists.
I don't have a Tumblr.
No, but you're not a Tumblr feminist. You know what I'm talking about with Tumblr
feminism. Oh yeah, I do.
You know, and it's and so what you end up
with. I don't get Tumblr.
We all have a mutual friend we won't name, mm-hmm. but we have a mutual friend who is a great guy and is not a misogynist and is not an awful dude, but who sides with the better notions of that underbelly of the men's rights group. And then seizes on to some of their movements that make sense to him. The things like Not All Men. And you see that reaction coming. And what it comes from is exactly what we're talking about here. It's how we have a society that perpetuates not only gender roles, but perpetuates this almost supernatural mythology of gender roles. Mm-hmm. And as a result, we treat things differently. You know, it's one of those things where when a man and a woman get divorced, you know, well, she carried, you know, the baby for 9 months, you know, and she has a biological connection that the man doesn't have, but that's just the start of it. It gets to a different point to where,
it's still tied back to that idea of the mother is going to be more caring, and you can't deprive a child of their mother, but you can deprive a child of their father.
And as long as that gets perpetuated, it's going to bleed out into everything, including film. And mm-hmm. you're going to have, because until we, in fact, the one thing I like to tell.
It's the standby with feminism, right? That feminism is everybody's rights.
Yeah.
If we solve how we treat women, we will solve how we treat men.
Sure. No, absolutely. Which is why I'm with you guys. You know, it's why I can explain the notion behind the men's rights activists. But you'll never, ever, ever find me anywhere with them going, you know, they have a point. I agree that there's some serious points at that core and that laws need to be equalized, but let's then equalize the laws all the way around. But we
agree.
But we run into problems, and we run into problems like all of a sudden we ask the question, well, why is it a woman's right to terminate a child, but a man can't have any say to either prevent the termination of their child?
Or to say, I'm fine, you're having the baby, but I'm...
Exactly.
I opt out.
And
I'm for that.
But you are in a small minority of voices.
Well, then he shouldn't have put his dick in there. And I'm like, that is, now we're back to, you're telling somebody else how you're making choices for somebody else.
Exactly. And mm-hmm. This is the argument that we are having at its core. And this argument, this one right here, is one of the big ones for the men's rights activists, is that they agree with us. And they say, we should have this, and why can't we have this? And the argument is because you have no right to tell me whether or not I can have an abortion, and because it's my body. And that...
But you also don't get to opt out if you did something you didn't intend to do.
Exactly.
Which is BS.
And, mm-hmm. But you know what? I bet
we need a society that cares for all of our children regardless, and then none of this will be a problem.
I agree, but I bet you there's people listening right now screaming at us both like we're crazy because they think we're nuts. And maybe they're right, but we don't seem to think we're nuts.
I don't know.
But yeah, this is, I mean, and these problems are what we get echoes of in all the other elements, including that. As I like to tell people, the day men and women are equal may happen in our lifetime. We might see it. We're going to be really old. No.
Really freaking old.
I raise my eyebrows and I tilt my head, listeners who cannot see me, because it seems like this is something so deeply ground down into our culture. I don't know how we will ever come over it. But at the same time, I grew up at a time where you didn't even have gay characters on TV. You couldn't even acknowledge gay characters on TV. Being gay was a problem in so many ways, and not even just within my own lifetime, but seriously, in a really short amount of time, that has turned around sharply.
What I think might happen, what I see, the future I see, is when we're old, and we're hanging out at a convention at the age of 75.
All these kids today.
Yeah. Well, no.
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, no. We're going to see that. It's going to be, oh, these kids today. What we're going to see is we're going to see a guy and a girl get into an argument and then start beating the shit out of each other. And then they're going to stop, hug it out, kiss, go have a beer together. And as long as they're cool with it, everyone else will be cool with it. And we're going to look at that and we're going to be, you know, in my day, a man never hit a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to be, shut up, grandpa. In your day, you didn't even pay women what you paid men.
Yeah.
You know, don't come and talk to me about what's right, how to treat women. You treated women in a much worse way than we did.
We are treating everybody equal.
Everyone's equal. And you know what? She shouldn't have said that about my mom, and I hit her. And she apologized after she gave me a black eye, and we're cool. But that's the thing is, if me and a male friend get drunk one night and go out and we start arguing and we go out in the street, we beat the crap out of each other and hug it out afterwards and go back in and keep drinking, everyone's going to be like, what the fuck? But all right, okay, yeah, they're cool with it, then cool, and everyone will laugh it off. But if I do that with one of you, unacceptable.
Well, and there is the one problem that I bring up philosophically, which is fair isn't always equal and equal isn't always fair. And that is part of the issue, is that biologically men are larger and stronger for the most part. And so there is an inequality there of like, well, yes, it would be fair. It would be equal for men and women to be able to hit each other equally. But it is not necessarily fair in that a man can probably deliver a much more effective blow. But I'm not saying I'm against your theory. I'm just bringing up as a philosophical aside.
But if me and Shaq got into a fight and did the same thing, you guys wouldn't be horrified. Like, oh my God, Shaq's so much bigger than Cargill. He's got strength and reach.
I'd be like, Cargill, what the hell are you thinking?
Well, no, exactly. But that's exactly what we're going to get to, is what the hell were you thinking if you're getting in an argument with a guy who's got 100
pounds
on you.
Windy, you're
5 foot. Yeah.
And you're seriously saying that to Cargill, who's got your... whose arms are as long as you are tall? Why would you say that to somebody who can bend you into a pretzel?
Exactly. And I feel eventually we'll get there, but it's going to take at least two generations. It's going to take two generations of growing up. It's going to be this generation fighting for the basic rights. And then it's going to be a generation that's going to argue and have to have it out over the really hard questions, like what we were just talking about.
Well, but even so, there's, as we see with the residuals from slavery, right, and the Jim Crow laws, is, yeah, racism in America is a lot better, right? Polite society is not racist. Racism is going strong in America. It's just gone underground.
Well, yeah.
No, it's not quite underground.
It's just unspoken.
It's manifesting in different ways.
Racism is just like sexism in that no matter where you go, it always exists. And no matter what happens, it's always going to exist because we natively, the brilliant thing about our biology, you know, that whether you believe it just happened by accident or whether we were created to be this way, our biology filters things out. We have about 30 different sounds going on around us right now, but all you're hearing is my voice because your brain is filtering out the air conditioning and the buzzing of the light and the ticking of the clock, and you're not hearing any of that.
I'm hearing them now.
Now that you're thinking about it. But that's just it, is we it starts with that. We filter out things. You guys are looking at me right now and you're not seeing the fact that I'm taking up a very small portion of your eyesight and there's actually so much more around me, and you filter that out. And then,
do you know why I do that? Because I've seen too many horror movies, and I know if I pay attention to the background, I'll see something I don't want to see.
But, yeah, and it's very true right now. So then it moves on, and we start differentiating between, well, I know this type of food tastes like this, and this type of food tastes like this, and I prefer this. And sometimes I prefer this because I really do just prefer this. And sometimes I prefer this because my body has an iron deficiency and it's telling me I prefer this because it gives me more iron. And we have that. And then we get to, you know, the more social things. And it's like,
our brains are filtering and our brains are categorizing and grouping. That is what our brains
do. And whenever you have people of any given race or any given sex having their own separate ecology of sorts, people are going to differentiate on that.
Yeah.
And until everything and anything is shared and everything is, we all speak one language and we all, you know, we all have one base society, which we'll never have, you know, we'll never have everybody is, you know, we can't look at how we make fun of people from other parts of our own country.
Well, and if we got there, I think we'd all be looking around for the Morlocks, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so.
Okay, this is too perfect.
Yeah.
What the hell?
But so what you end up with is we're always going to differentiate. So misogyny and racism is always going to exist in some way. And misandry is always going to exist in some sort of way.
I would just really like it to have to go underground. It's
well,
true.
But that's, and that's where we got to talking about last time, which is where the social pressure really comes in and where, like, I appreciate the notion of dude, not cool. I think that's good, and I think that's great for friends, for generally speaking.
But well, and also you have to understand, and it did come from a man who wrote it. A man wrote it.
Yes.
But it is also uniquely suited to a female point of view, which is, I want to call out your behavior, make you aware of it, and put social pressure on you. But I want to do it in such a way that it does not completely derail the social context and make me look like the asshole. Because that's the flip side.
Sure.
When you call somebody out on their behavior, now you're harshing the social context, and now you're the asshole.
Yeah, and I just wonder where we would be in this country right now if Martin Luther King had just said, dude, not cool. Or if our generation had just looked at
But when a woman does it, there's the just, extra added bonus.
But I'm talking about specifically what, you know, and this was why we got into this podcast to begin with. I'm talking about what men need to do.
Yep.
And I think what men need to do is be a lot harsher on people that we encounter that do that. Because the problem is there is no law that will cure this. You know, there are laws that would help. No, well, there's some that you think would help but don't. The one that I always run into is an equal pay law. You know, people talking about requiring by law equal pay for men and women. And that is one of the biggest nightmares I've ever heard of. And it's when you actually work that out and ask the real questions, because it sounds like it's fair. It sounds like a good idea. It's like just right there. Hey, we require that you pay a man equal to what you pay a woman. Okay. Well, how do you enforce that? And not just in, well, let us look at your books. Now everybody's pay has to be public. And now everybody's pay is comparative based on, in order to get a job, you can't be paid on your own value as a person. You have to be paid a standard amount that this company sets to pay someone who's worked at this company for 7 years with X experience. We can't offer Cargill more to come and work at our company, even though we prize him and we think Cargill's the best at this thing in the world. We can't pay him more because we would have to also pay a woman exactly the same amount. And paying a woman exactly the same amount isn't just that. We'd have to pay everyone the same amount. And so all of a sudden, you undercut the entire economic structure.
I disagree with your reasoning, but I don't disagree with your conclusion. Okay. An equal pay law is very problematic. But I do think an equal pay law would have value, not in so much in its practical effects, but in its symbolic effects as a statement of this is what our society values. Our society believes people should be paid the same, motherfuckers.
But,
so pay the fuck attention.
But at the same time.
Okay, your turn.
Also, I think the, you know, just in general, I think the privacy of pay scales is kind of bullshit.
I think if people started talking about what they were getting paid, it'd be a lot harder for companies to pull this shit.
I don't disagree.
Yeah.
But see, what I think is, I think, you know, I really changed my mind on this recently, having watched what happened. And I talked about this, and I'm sure that portion probably still exists in the previous podcast.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know.
Unless I was talking to it, sorry.
No. This was actually a part where you passed out. And you look at. How far we've gotten with gay rights in this country over the last 20 years, purely through social pressure.
Yeah.
No president has walked in and passed a straight law that says this is okay. And it's happening not just on a legal level, it's trickling down. We're seeing churches across the country start to rule that gay marriage is acceptable in their church.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no law in this country that can ever be passed, because it's a violation of the First Amendment, that could ever force a church to have to grant somebody a marriage in their church. But we're finding churches starting to do it because of the social pressure, because they're finding they're failing, and they're failing, and they're losing people because these kids are growing up going, I don't agree with your values. Mm-hmm.
If this is your Jesus and this is your church, then I don't want your Jesus and I don't want your church, and therefore you don't get my money.
And if we start treating companies like that, we start shaming, the way you win this is by shaming the companies specifically that are paying their female employees.
Which
less.
Means we need to start finding out what people are paying.
Well, but that's what the conversation needs to be. Instead of arguing and bickering over a law that isn't going to do what we need it to do, we need to start having the conversation, hey, why are we hiding how much we make? But so these are the issues that we really need to work on, and that do bleed into film. And we can, in certain ways, use film to influence people's perceptions.
Mm-hmm. I mean, because let's face it, Hollywood is a mirror, but Hollywood is also a mirror that lags behind what's really going on. But it's still based on data that is old by the time
Sometimes.
But Hollywood can also be forward-thinking. I mean, you can't, you know, just go charging right out there with an entirely new idea, but Hollywood and media in general can gently nudge society in a direction.
Well, yeah. Also just pay attention to, like, if the kids that are coming up that are the market that you find so sexy and are soon to be an even sexier market with their own money and youth, then what are they like? Well, let's give them that, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, but we're starting to see the effects on that. I mean, if you spend any time on Reddit at all, who's the most popular person ever on Reddit? Who's the one person who you can mention in a comment on Reddit or post a photo
besides
on Reddit?
Besides Unidan?
Who's more popular than Unidan?
I don't know.
Jennifer Lawrence.
Oh, J-Law.
Guys, and guys will drop money and go see a Jennifer Lawrence movie. And they will do it gladly, and not just because they find her super hot, but because she is just awesome, and they believe she can do
her
anything.
Her brand, whoever's managing her, or if it's her that's managing her, she is branding herself beautifully.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but, absolutely.
But she is taking all these great roles for strong women, and sometimes not so strong women, sometimes very flawed women. You look at her character in American Hustle.
I haven't seen American Hustle yet, but Silver Linings Playbook for me.
Oh, no, she's amazing in Silver Linings Playbook, but in American Hustle, you hate her. She's essentially like that great performance by, what is her name? She was the hotness a few years back in The Town, who was also in Green Lantern.
Blake Lively.
Yes. So Blake Lively in The Town. She's so great, but she's this scumbag townie who really does kind of end up screwing him over in ways. And she's very much like that in American Hustle. She's not a good person. You get her. She makes sense. Mm-hmm. But she's kind of an awful human fucking being. And she nails it and does it in such a great way. And so she doesn't typecast herself as someone who only plays... Mm-hmm. I only play strong women. No, she plays all women. But when she plays strong women, she's fucking great.
Oh, we were just talking about
we actually talked about your next at length with Megan.
That was one we meant to talk about, but I don't think we ever talked about it.
Yeah, I think we name dropped it, but
that character in your next is so good. Yeah.
That's where Jesus comes from. Was talking about your next because what brought that.
But
out
that's
of my mom.
But that character. What's so cool about your next? What's so great about that particular character is that movie very subtly plays upon that thing that I was talking about in the previous part of the episode, mm-hmm. when I was talking about Baisemois, where men just one of the problems that men have in our culture is we underestimate women.
Yeah.
And we never think that women are a threat. And mm-hmm. he never, ever, ever thinks that this girl could screw up his plans and that she could actually be really good at stuff that he never even thought about.
Well, and we were talking about this, the dudes in the masks who think they're badasses because they're war vets, and they're just, oh, look at us, and we got guns. And even when she is just like handed their ass to them, they're still like, well, I don't understand what happened. We were joking about it. It's like those poor guys didn't realize it feels like she's already been in a horror movie that was much worse than this horror movie. And these poor guys just walked into a zombie apocalypse film and they think they're in a heist film.
Yeah.
Right. And so they're showing up like, we're badasses. And then somebody from a zombie apocalypse film is like, no, you're not. I will kill you now. I will kill you. I will kill you so dead. Double tap.
Yeah. Given that it's almost 3 a.m, we should
wrap it up.
Wrap it up. We should
wrap it up, flip it, slump, rub it down. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Just
so are there any final parting thoughts on this topic? I feel like we gotten the larger issues. Cultural stuff. I'm waving my hands and gesticulating wildly.
Great radio.
Always great radio. That actually was sort of summarizing in a sort of way, but is there anything you want to throw out there, Cargill, just to wrap this up?
No, I think we pretty much covered it. I think ultimately we just need to, I guess the big final parting thought, the big, you know, thing that I want to hang on this is that it's really important for all of the people in the middle of this conversation to ignore the Tumblr feminists and to ignore the men's rights advocates and stop writing blogs about how dumb this person is and how dumb that idea is and stop focusing on, you know, we believe in evolution on this here, right?
Yeah.
Many of the people listening to this probably are big fans of evolution. The whole concept of evolution, in fact, this is one of the things that frustrates me right now. The Republican Party is built on the core idea of evolution. It is the survival of the fittest, but they don't believe in evolution. Mm-hmm. And the Democratic Party believes in evolution, but tries to circumvent survival of the fittest.
Yeah.
And one of the biggest problems we see in the ignorance on both of these sides with this concept is that we have all these people that want to come across as smart. And the number one way they come across as smart is by tearing apart someone else's thoughts or ideas and proving how much smarter they are than them. And so they pick people that are dumber than them. And so what we have is an entire media right now that is taking and giving a megaphone to the dumbest ideas to show that they're smart by tearing apart the ideas that most people should be able to tear apart anyway, rather than fighting against the bigger, harder ideas and trying to make themselves smarter. And so what we have right now are these two loud groups that are fucking us over because they're the only people we're hearing. And we shouldn't have to hear that. And what we need is more people in the middle, more people who are good, honest, average, everyday people starting to think and talk about how we can make this world a better place, rather than just getting angry at each other over our sex. And it really is something where if you're someone, you don't have to be an angry feminist to tell a dude to shut the fuck up and not treat a woman like that. The final parting thought is that we need to stop focusing on those extremists and start focusing on the real solutions of real people that we can work out. You and I sat here on the couch tonight and we actually agreed on a major feminist issue.
That's not unheard of for us, Cargill.
On a big one. I honestly thought you were going to tear into me for even suggesting that a man have any say in a pregnancy.
And I
love that we get, but the thing is these conversations need to happen. We need to talk about the real issues and not the bullshit issues. Because if we start solving some of these real issues, we start shaming the people who you know, treat women poorly. We start finding ways to filter out these people who say terrible, you know, terrible, awful things.
We stop giving them extra attention.
Yes.
Yeah.
Then we will start to raise the next generations who will solve this problem. We will not solve this problem. The next two generations are going to solve these problems. And we just have to raise them to make sure they grow up in an environment where it's not a problem and where the issues go away. And that takes us finding the right ways to talk about it, which is the whole reason I wanted to come on my friend's podcast with two feminists and discuss feminism with them. So now the questions.
Oh, the questions.
Okay, question number one. Who are you?
I'm C. Robert Cargill.
I can see Robert Cargill. He's right there.
I see what you did there.
It's 3 in the morning, yay. All right, number two, what do you do?
I write, I drink lots of coffee, I'm a pretty damn good husband.
You are.
I will say, I don't know if you're a good husband. I know you are a super appreciative husband.
Yeah.
Right? You are definitely somebody who acknowledges the awesomeness of your wife frequently, which you should, because she is awesome.
She is super freaking awesome.
Dear listeners, I pretty much live at the Cargill's house. Cargill's house for about 2 weeks out of the year for various film events, and it is a lovely place to be.
It is a lovely place.
They are both lovely people, and they love each other.
Plus, it's puppy dogs.
Question number three. What is in your personal dream pleasure dome? Like, if you were to make a man cave for yourself, what would be in it?
Cave or a pleasure dome?
If Kublai Khan
said, Cargill, you get to decree, what would be in it?
Stand-up arcade.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Yeah. That would, I mean, that's a pleasure dome, baby.
So, George's house.
Well, kind of. George has like three games that I'm thinking more like pinballs, but bigger.
Okay. Yeah.
You're such a size queen.
And number four, give us a pleasure dome recommendation. Something that you can recommend to our listeners that you have discovered recently that you really like.
It could be anything.
Yeah. It could be a t-shirt. It could be a website. It could be a film, whatever.
I am madly in love with Marvel Heroes 2015. It is a free-to-play ARPG, action RPG, that was designed by the David Brevik, who designed Diablo and Diablo 2.
Oh, okay.
And it's essentially Diablo with superheroes. And it is nerdy, nerdy, nerdy as hell. It's free to play. There's 11 characters that you can choose from at the start. They put out a new character every month, sometimes two, but they're constantly putting out new skins for the characters so that you can play your favorite iterations of characters. Like, my favorite character to play is Miss Marvel, but I play her as Binary, which is who she was in the 80s and early 90s in X-Men comics. I also play Iron Man, and I play him in the Hulkbuster armor. I play Hulk as Mr. Fix-It, which is going to, most people out there won't know what Mr. Fix-It is.
Extra nerdy. You're right.
Oh yeah. When the period of time when Hulk was Gray Hulk and he was a bit smarter, as smart as the average man, but smaller and a bit weaker and had gray skin, and he decided to go off to Vegas to become a bouncer for the mob, and he was called Mr. Fix-It, and so I play Hulk as Mr. Fix-It, because it's that kind of game. It's, you don't have to put in money to play the game. You could actually go through and collect all the characters without having to pay, but if you pay, you can get some of the super awesome nerdy skins and bonuses and benefits and such. And it's such an addictive game. It's just so cool. And I usually try to get an hour or two in a day of playing that, and sometimes on the weekends. But it's the best thing about it is that it's the development team very much listens to their community. Mm-hmm. And so what the community wants, the community gets. And they're always adding new styles of play, new modes of play, new content, new characters. So the game's ever evolving. And, you know, if you leave the game for 3 months and come back, you're going to find things that are radically different than when you left. And so they're always fixing things. They're always giving you something new to play with. Like, just this month, we got Silver Surfer. And on the day Silver Surfer came out, I was just like, I'm getting Silver Surfer to level 60. Yeah. Last month was Psylocke, and I blew through Psylocke in a weekend. And it's really fun. So if you're a comic fan and a video game fan, they just released it for the Mac. It's been on PC for a year, mm-hmm. and now you can download it for the Mac.
I can't help but enjoy the fact that you tell us this, as somebody who has been a professional reviewer and critic, because you deliver it all and then you have the plug at the end. And if you're someone like this, they just released it for this, blah, blah, blah. And it was so beautifully constructed.
I don't get to spend a lot of time talking about Marvel Heroes, and it's my one geeky addiction that I don't have an outlet professionally to deal with, or that, it's that Warhammer are my thing. So,
awesome.
The title Warhammer always makes me giggle.
Warhammer 40,000 years.
Well, thank you very much for joining us on Xanadu Cinema Pleasure Dome for a very extended amount of time on this one subject.
Yes. No problem. We were going to sit around and talk about this shit anyway.
Yeah, and we did. There was this whole conversation we had during lunch, too, that wasn't recorded. It's amazing. I have conversations off of podcasts. Anyway.
Well, I refuse to believe it. I think you record everything secretly. Yeah. You're like Nixon.
I live on the internet. Anyway, thank you very much, listeners, for joining us. We love you all.
Goodbye. Good night.
And I was Melissa. That's Wendy.
Yeah, I am. And that's C. Robert Cario.
Hi, everybody.
Yay.
Thank you for joining us in the Xanadu Cinema Pleasure Dome. Our theme song was written by Tim Wick and Jeffrey Brown and recorded and mastered by Chad Dutton. New episodes arrive every Thursday. You can find us on iTunes and on Stitcher. You can also visit us at xanaducinema.com, follow us on Twitter at xanaducinema, and like us on Facebook at Xanadu Cinema Pleasure Dome.
Super
the C
awkward.
Is for Christ.